Hey everyone, Michael here. Thanks for downloading this latest episode of M4 Edge. Before we get started with our interview of Kevin Desai of Taffy, a few quick notes. First, a plea to all of you who are enjoying our show to let us know about it and let others know about it. You can email us at info@m4edge.com or Michael@m4edge or Marco@m4edge. But we'd really love it if you would rate us on iTunes or your favorite podcast listening app, and particularly if you would write a review on iTunes and let the world know what you think about it. That really would help. We're still brand new, as you know, and so we could use as much publicity as we can get. So if you have the inclination, please share about us on social, on Facebook or on Twitter, or on LinkedIn, whatever you use. Let others know about the show. If we didn't notice, tell us that you did it, and we'll give you a special shout out at the beginning of the next episode. So thanks in advance to those of you who will do that. Next, I think some of you have found our Off the Edge section on the website, where Marco and I post some things we are interested in that are not relevant specifically to our podcast. Some of them are, of course, on the same themes because we're interested in the stuff. Some of them are totally separate and hence off the edge. Some of the stuff are articles we've read or music videos we've seen or other podcasts we've listened to that we think you'd like as well. Just kind of a random collection of stuff we're into. We're interested in what you're into also. So we're starting a new section on the website that we're going to call Listener's Edge. And this could be just things that you think we would be interested in and you'd like to share with others. These could be articles you've found or articles you've written, maybe, or music or movies or podcasts or books or whatever. Just kind of let us know what you're into. And we're trying to build a community here of listeners. So send in those links to info or Michael or Marco at M4 Edge. Next note, this episode, upcoming episode with Kevin, is a little bit more technical at times than we've had in the past. So I interject here and there to explain what's going on. It gets a little wonky, but we do our best to make it more digestible for a general audience. At the end of the conversation with Kevin, Marco and I have, like we did in the last two episodes, tacked on our own conversation about Taffy and about this technology and this technology space. I think it's actually one of our more fun conversations. So even though it's a little bit long, I encourage you to stick it out and give it a try. I'm pretty sure you'll enjoy it. That's it for now. Thanks again for listening and enjoy the show.
Companies like Taffy, you know, we call ourselves like boots on the ground. We're the plumbers, we're the builders of the aqueducts. Without us first, we're not going to get to the more glamorous use cases that are out there that, you know, that we want. We want to make that a possibility for the future. We want companies to build on top of our foundation to create better machine learning algorithms, to create better AI, to solve and prevent. You know, a lot of this is all about prevention. We want to prevent mistakes from being made. We want to prevent doctors from doing things that are unnecessary simply because it was the way they used to do it. And we want to prevent patients from having to go and see the doctor in the first place.
Hi, I am Marco Annunziata, and welcome to M4 Edge, that is
Macro, Micro, Michael, Marco, and Startups at the Edge. I'm Michael Leifman, and our guest today is Kevin Desai, co-founder of Taffy. Taffy, not the candy, is a healthcare IT startup that is striving to ensure interoperability of data for hospitals, insurers, and other healthcare players.
I know what you're wondering. With all the exciting developments we hear about in healthcare, from personalized medicine to genetic engineering, why would you want to listen to something as boring as data interoperability?
Way to sell the episode. Well, the real reason is because while the promise of data-driven miracle cures is awe-inspiring, healthcare lags far behind many other sectors in its ability to collect, share, and utilize data. We discussed with Kevin why creating a better data infrastructure is essential to providing the quality of healthcare that we demand.
And to reduce its cost. The current inability to share and compare healthcare data causes tremendous inefficiencies, which translate in much higher costs for everyone in the system. And healthcare expenditures are already rising at an unsustainable pace.
We'll also discuss how all this is already changing our personal experience, when we show up at the doctor's office, something with which most of you can probably relate, as well as the future challenges that TAFE and the healthcare sector in general will contend with.
Thanks for being curious. Enjoy the episode and...
Welcome to M4 Edge.
Excellent. Then let's get started. And our guest today is Kevin Desai. Kevin is the co-founder of TAFE. TAFE is a healthcare IT company which provides a data integration platform. And Kevin will tell us a lot more about it. But first of all, before we get started, a full disclosure on my side. I currently serve as a technical advisor for TAFE. So I can be either excessively positive or excessively negative on the company, depending on how the conversation goes, but I have skin in the game. And Kevin, thanks very much for being with us today. It's a great pleasure, and we really look forward to the conversation.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks, Kevin, for joining us. And so Marco obviously knows quite a bit more about the company than I do. And so why don't you start out, if you would, by telling us really what problem TAFE is trying to solve. And to use a phrase that's become one of Marco's catchphrases here, why on earth are you doing this? You're one of the co-founders, so why are you doing this?
Yeah, no, great questions. So TAFE's purpose is to simplify the process of connecting healthcare data between organizations, such as provider organizations like hospitals, health systems, doctor's offices, or physician practices, as well as payer organizations like your Blue Crosses and Blue Shields, Aetnas and Cignas of the world. Additionally, also connecting them with their vendors and with other allied companies or corporations that participate in the healthcare spectrum, such as pharmaceutical companies, medical device manufacturers, digital device manufacturers, and this new kind of consumer side, consumer device space that's growing in healthcare and personalized medicine. So in healthcare, there are over 36 what we would call data standards. Some of them are very loosely called standards because they're really not standardized. And it's created a very large problem in terms of exchanging information about patients, about patient care, about quality of care, about cost across the United States and even globally. And this problem is only growing bigger as the proliferation of data continues to expand. And it's ballooning a huge cost inside of a lot of organizations. And that cost eventually gets passed on to the consumers and to the payer organizations like the federal government and nations governments, and makes it really difficult to for communities to afford to take care of themselves and for people to take care of themselves. So that's kind of TAFE's space. Is trying to figure out the best way to exchange that information simply and at a really cost-effective way. And the reason that I'm doing it is because I like pain and punishment more than anything else in this world, because that's what it takes to survive in healthcare IT, which is the specific service area that TAFE lives in.
Thanks. That helps. So when you say costs have been ballooning, is that because of amount of data that gets collected or because of the lack of a logical repository to put it in and share the data across? Or is it because the different types of data? What is driving costs to balloon in the healthcare data world?
So there are a number of reasons why costs expanded healthcare. The one specifically that TAFE is very interested in, though, is the rising IT costs and the ability or inability for organizations to leverage huge swaths or volumes of valuable data to drive cost efficiency in healthcare. So understanding material management or supply management between organizations, such as a medical device supplier and a healthcare organization, or even within a community, several different hospitals, identifying common data that can be used to improve the quality of care delivered directly to a patient. There are a number of use cases and scenarios where this type of complexity is either prohibiting costs from being managed appropriately or further exacerbating the problem and continuing to allow costs to rise with really no oversight or recourse.
So Kevin, here we're getting deep into the weeds, but before we rise up and take more of a bird's eye view of the situation, let's get even deeper into the weeds. We're talking about all these kind of data. Tell us a little bit more about exactly what kind of data TAFE's customers need to operate with. Where are the data generated? How are they inputted into the various systems? Why are they so different to integrate? How do the standards come in?
Great question. So we'll start with clinical data. It's one of my most favoriteest of topics. Clinical data is the type of information that gets collected when a person presents to a doctor's office, possibly gets admitted into a hospital, or that data is generated through some sort of device that may be following that patient when they're outside of clinical care. So for instance, if you're a diabetic patient, you might have a glucometer, and that glucometer generates all sorts of data about your blood sugar levels throughout the day, and your doctor is going to want to collect that next time you go in for a visit. So your physician collects your glucometer data from home. They may order some labs for you. You go to the lab. The lab sends that data back to the doctor. And subsequently, as a person, you may get admitted into the emergency department because you haven't been taking your medication as diligently as you should have. And then you're going to have more information that gets generated. And all of this information, your laboratory results, your physical exam from the physician, any of your past medical history that was captured, and then any of the device information, for instance, if you have medications being administered through an IV or through some sort of point of care device, is going to start being captured throughout the care continuum and stored into a clinical data model or into a system known as electronic medical record. And that is one of the largest repositories for this data. There are a number of major electronic medical record vendors out there, and not a single one of them looks like or stores your clinical data the same as the other.
You've painted quite a clear picture of a situation which is, in my view, stunning in its inefficiency. And I've been at a number of healthcare conferences and smaller roundtables where people, you know, healthcare experts and practitioners complain about this very loudly. It is recognized as being an enormous headache for people operating in the sector. So clearly there is some effort to try to address it. Kevin, tell us a bit more. Why should we think that TAFE is special? Who are the main competitors in this field, and why is TAFE better than the rest?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. It's a shameless way for me to pitch. So one of the things that has been happening since, I want to say, like the mid-2000s, has been this push for interoperability in healthcare.
Interoperability. That's the term of art for the property of computer systems or software systems that allows one system to interact with the other. If systems can, quote, speak to each other, they're interoperable. So interoperability is the ability of systems to exchange information and use the exchanged information. If disparate databases don't use the same nomenclature, for example, then interoperability is a challenge. And you can see that in health records, interoperability among different health systems would be a really important feature.
For good reason. It's a way to ensure that patients can get the best care possible, which is really the ultimate goal of healthcare overall. In doing so, there have been a number of large initiatives to move that needle forward. Things like the Argonaut Project, which companies like Apple are big sponsors of.
That's the Argonaut Project. Lots of wonky background here, so hang tight. The Argonaut Project is an initiative launched by a group called Health Level 7 International, or HL7. HL7 identifies itself as the global authority for interoperability, there's that word again, in healthcare information technology, with members in 55 countries. So HL7 is a not-for-profit. It promotes the use of informatics standards among healthcare organizations. It's a community of healthcare subject matter experts and information scientists. So HL7 launches this Argonaut Project. And why the name Argonaut? It's a reference to another organization of affiliated scientists named Jason, as in Greek mythology's Jason and the Argonauts. The Jason Project advises the U.S. government on lots of different issues, and in 2012, assembled a task force of health IT experts who in late 2013, published a report on health interoperability standards. So you got that? There's the JSON project, then the JSON Task Force on Health Interoperability. They issue the task force report. Then later HL7 creates the Argonaut project, which is an extension of the JSON report using JSON as its namesake. I told you it was wonky.
The development of the FHIR, or the FHIR standard, which is an API specific to healthcare that many are adopting.
A little more wonkiness here. FHIR, or FHIR, is Fast Healthcare Interoperability Resources. It's a standard for data for exchanging electronic health records. FHIR also includes an API, or Application Programming Interface. An API is kind of a software shortcut. It gives software developers standard commands for common operations, so they don't have to write everything from scratch. So FHIR, FHIR, is the interoperability standard and the set of software shortcuts for providing that interoperability. And can you guess who created FHIR? It was HL7, of course, but I bet you knew that already.
But in doing these large broad-based projects, what ends up happening is you start creating these consortiums that really cater towards the larger, more well-funded organizations and entities. And the boots on the ground organizations, family medical centers, smaller vendors or more innovative vendors are left waiting for these solutions to be implemented or to be adopted more broadly before their solutions can enter the market or be utilized. And it slows innovation. It slows innovation somewhat and also skews it somewhat unfairly for a number of entities. So TAFI's goal is to democratize that process while maintaining some level of cohesive cross-mapping back to these broader standards. So TAFI's API, which is kind of the cornerstone of our platform, is a simple reflection of the FHIR standard, which is what most of the industry is going to move towards in terms of interoperability. And what we do is we reduce the barrier to entry for organizations or entities to innovate, whether they're large pharmaceutical companies, medical device manufacturers, insurance payers, provider organizations, or even physician offices. They can start working on TAFI's API, start exchanging data interoperably with a number of current standards, as well as a number of future standards, and do so at a more rapid clip than they would otherwise by waiting for some of these other larger standards to be adopted more readily.
And so the TAFI business model, the API that you said is sort of the crux of your offering, is basically a software implementation of FHIR, correct?
It's a software implementation of a FHIR, I would say like a FHIR light. FHIR is a very nested and large API. It's somewhat complex given the fact that healthcare itself is relatively complex. And it's not widely adopted yet by a lot of vendors easily. So if you imagine you ordered something from IKEA and it was 150,000 pieces, it might take you quite a while to build it, and you don't necessarily know if you're going to end up using it by the time it's done. You get TAFI and it's like 50 pieces, and it's going to come up way faster, and you're still going to be able to leverage all of the same benefits of a larger, more broad-based API like FHIR.
You know, this is, it's, I don't know, Michael, if you have a follow-up question on this.
You saw me sort of hesitating.
Yeah.
So your initial question about, you know, why is TAFI necessarily better than its competitors? So what's to stop, Kevin, what's to stop Google or Amazon or any of the majors from building an API like yours?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So Google does have an API like ours. Google bought a company called Apigee, I believe was the name. Apigee had their HealthX API. Google has either adopted it or created their own, possibly leveraging some parts of it to create their Google API, which is also a FHIR-based API. We actually have been looking at Google as a potential partner for a lot of the type of work that TAFI does. Some of the things that differentiate us from our competitors is our ability to ingest data from any of the current existing standards and map it back to our API in a smart, in a more logical fashion that helps our innovators get their products up and working faster. So some of the challenges that especially our larger competitors would have is in order to make their solutions hardened and meet some of the requirements for their current customer bases. They're having to deal with large implementations that require a lot of custom effort. One of the areas where TAPI is able to succeed and where we kind of separate ourselves from our competitors, we have relatively small implementations, a relatively small implementation effort, even for large customers. And that's predicated based on how we designed our ingestion technology to feed our data model.
Kevin, I want to stay for a moment on the comparison with Google and some of the other giants that Michael brought up and raise the following point, the issue of the relative importance of domain knowledge. So see, a couple of months ago, we saw Google, Amazon, Salesforce, IBM, Oracle, and Microsoft, I think, being reported as having signed a pledge to speed up health data interoperability. And I looked at that and I thought, okay, this sounds like a formidable challenge, but it also brought to mind some of the discussions that we had within GE when we were looking at industrial internet technology. And Michael and I were in this position where at GE, we always used to say, yes, big data giants can come into the space, but we as GE have the domain expertise in these fields, in energy, in aviation, and that matters a lot. How is it playing out in your case? To what extent and how is the data, so the deep domain knowledge expertise that you and your colleagues in TAFI has, how does it matter? Why does it matter?
Well, one of the big components of the space that we're in. Again, I'll go back to the quote-unquote 36 standards. Those 36 standards encompass hundreds of thousands of data elements across financial components of patient care, specific types of medicine, such as oncology, hematology, nephrology. And so when we look at companies like Oracle, Microsoft, Google, Amazon, coming into this space, actually companies like us, like TAPI, we get excited because we don't see them as an impending threat. What we see is more opportunity for organizations to solve what are possibly some of the biggest problems we have in melding IT with medicine. For TAPI to introduce product into the market, we have to be extremely narrow. We're a startup, and we're not going to solve every problem with a high level of proficiency. But the ones that we do solve, we can solve really well. When companies like Google and Apple and Microsoft shine a spotlight on healthcare, it's empowering for us because it gives other innovators and other health systems and other constituents in this space hope that these larger broad-based problems are going to get solved more rapidly than they've ever been solved before. I generally quote healthcare at being about 10 to 15 years behind other industries such as manufacturing and banking when it comes to interoperation of data standards. You can take a screw from any manufacturer of your traditional screws, nuts, and bolts across the world in 150 different languages, and everyone will have the same product ID code for it. You could not do that for a single piece of your finger between different hospitals within a 10-mile radius in the U.S. So there is a lot of advantages to having these pledges made as long as they can double down and deliver on the promise. Because what we tend to see is a lot of action early on, and as people decide or determine how large some of these initiatives really are, they take a step back, and that's why I always like to say healthcare. To be in it, you got to really enjoy pain and punishment.
So, would it be fair to say that, to characterize what you just said, Kevin, as implying that to get things started on the right track in terms of addressing these data problems in healthcare, you do need to know healthcare. You need to know what the idiosyncratic interoperability problems are. You need to know how the sector works, and that's why you need specialists. And then to really scale the solutions, you might need the power of larger organizations.
I think absolutely you need specialists. There isn't a lot of room for error in healthcare because you're not dealing with that can be reversed easily. Clinical decisions have long-lasting implications and impacts for us, our families, for our communities. To make a mistake in how we map a clinical terminology or a set of clinical terminologies is not something that we can use like a new child type of mindset at approaching at this stage. We're a little bit too far down that rabbit hole. for something with commercial viability. That being said, there's still space and there's still room for those types of thought processes to create positive experiences for new products being developed and for new ways to address some of the interoperability challenges that we're having. And these larger vendors, these larger players in the space, you know, Googles and Amazons of the world, they're going to bring domain expertise into the space, and they're going to look at some of these problems at different angles. Amazon and Google may be looking at better ways to introduce machine learning into very repetitive processes around how we get patient transactions cleared through insurance carriers or through CMS and Medicare and Medicaid, which creates all sorts of logistical problems or that at the end trickle down into patient care because patients basically are left wondering whether they can afford to get their medications or afford to go see the doctor the next time they're sick. So there are just so many problems and so many angles of which we can tackle a lot of these challenges that everyone's contributions at this stage are going to be valuable. I'm assuming that we can start agreeing on, you know, how to address the challenges at a number of different levels. You know, the larger base, things like the Averna project, as I've mentioned before, and FHIR are very valiant efforts and they need to continue moving forward. And having the major players shining those spotlights on those initiatives is important.
So interoperability is kind of the magic word here. And at what point do you begin to reach or to approach diminishing returns? So obviously you're not there yet, and there's a ton of systems that don't work with each other and increasing amounts of data. But I would imagine that at some point, having additional interoperability doesn't help that much, doesn't help the patient that much, or doesn't help the hospital that much, or potentially not even the software vendor. You know, is there a way to think about how much you need? What's the magic number there?
I think people continue to think about that. Every time I feel like anyone comes and says, I think our interoperability is good enough, I always wait a few more months, maybe even a year, until the next major risk event happens. In healthcare, you only need one single adverse patient event to change the course of a patient's life. And, you know, that has lasting shockwaves throughout that healthcare system. There are legal implications. There are financial implications. There are, you know, at the precipice of this, there are, you know, life-changing implications to any of those adverse risk events. And interoperability can be a cornerstone for just and attributed to probably most any of those events that take place.
Kevin, as we're talking about health outcomes, our conversation brings up a question which is definitely in my mind, I'm sure it's in the minds of many of our listeners, which is the following. Currently, we read a lot of excited reports on how data and artificial intelligence are changing healthcare and pushing the frontiers of what is possible. They're going to make us live forever, bring us personalized medicine, targeted gene therapy, all diseases are going to be eradicated. And here with you, we're talking about instead a very basic challenge, that is health providers and health specialists being in a situation where they can't get their hands on the data they need in a coherent and interoperable way. So tell us a bit, talk to us a bit about the tension between these two realities and maybe the extent to which progress in interoperability is actually necessary and foundational for these more sexy advances that are so often talked about.
Yeah, no, I love that. AI and machine learning are very sexy and Taffy is a very unsexy company. So without a common data standard or without common data standards, things like machine learning are virtually impossible. You cannot run multiple cycles on a, or you cannot train multiple cycles of a learning algorithm on data that is not consistent or clean. So that's essentially saying for gender, I have documented every one of my patients was a male as a male. It can't be the letter M, it can't be a zero, it can't be some other identifier. It has to be consistent. So without clean or consistent data, without true interoperability between systems or the collection point of vast data across a variety of different scenarios, machine learning becomes complicated. Again, machine learning also requires a large volume of data, extremely large volume of data to get meaningful output. If I only have clean data on a million patients, I may not be getting as accurate of an output for my algorithm as if I had it on 100 million patients. So therein lies a lot of the challenge with getting to the more interesting output of developing AI or developing better machine learning in healthcare. how do we get larger volumes of consistent data into those systems so that we can get the promise that they hold and that they unlock? And that's kind of what companies like Taffy, we call ourselves like boots on the ground. We're the plumbers, we're the builders of the aqueducts. Without us first, we're not going to get to the more glamorous use cases that are out there that, you know, that we want. We want to make that a possibility for the future. We want companies to build on top of our foundation to create better machine learning algorithms, to create better AI, to solve and prevent. You know, a lot of this is about prevention. We want to prevent mistakes from being made. We want to prevent doctors from doing things that are unnecessary simply because it was the way they used to do it. And we want to prevent patients from having to go and see the doctor in the first place.
That's an interesting way to think about it. It's hard in some ways, I guess, to measure the success of data integration efforts if the outcome is fewer mistakes, right? You're measuring the absence of something. In thinking about the space and your company, one of the things that occurred to me was, look, people have been talking about this for decades, as you suggested. And it, you know, for me as an outsider, I would have expected more success stories. Maybe the unsung success here is that there are fewer screw-ups in hospitals. I'm wondering if there's been any sort of, you know, in nerdy economist terms, has there been any kind of hedonic study, you know, comparing one city with great data to another, or one hospital system with great data integration to another?
So it does get studied. And in general, healthcare is continuing to get better. There's no doubt that the quality of care is increasing. It's not decreasing. The question is, are we getting better faster than we were X number of years ago? And I don't know the answer to that. I don't read a lot of journals, you know, quite honestly, looking at it.
As a startup founder, you don't have time to read academic journals? I'm shocked.
I would if Marco wrote them.
There you go.
But the one thing that we like to always ask customers, whether they're innovators who are creating a new product, or their health organizations that want to bring more innovative technologies into their communities, what are some of the guiding principles for which you're trying to do this? Or why do you want this technology? What are you trying to solve? What are you trying to solve for? And more often than not, they're trying to keep their patients out of this volatile movement between a healthy and unhealthy state. And that's something that a lot of them are starting to try and look at a more macroscopic level across a community, across a region, or across an area where some of these health systems, you know, encompass maybe a large segment of a state or possibly across state lines. Can they reduce the amount of volatility in a patient's health? What I mean by that is oftentimes the patients that end up having the highest cost are the patients who float between these unhealthy and healthy states very rapidly. So they present to the doctor, they seem fine. They get admitted to the hospital, they're obviously not fine. They go to the doctor, they're not fine. They go to the hospital for an emergent scare, and they are fine. And that volatility creates a lot of unpredictability for healthcare organizations. It creates a lot of unpredictability for payers who have to flip the bill. And because of this volatility, hospitals are guarded on how they price their services and how they negotiate with their physicians and their insurance carriers. And insurance carriers and Medicare and Medicaid are kind of also left in this kind of strange space where they don't know what to expect from these communities. So oftentimes, we like to say that if we are able to prevent the volatility, if we're able to keep people healthy, keep them out of the doctor's offices for the right reasons, and then when they're in care, get them out of the hospital as quickly as possible with the highest, best outcome possible, that cost volatility should disappear. And that's some of the underlying premise of why a lot of healthcare organizations are shifting to this concept of accountable care, away and away from what's traditionally known as fee-for-service.
This actually brings to mind another interesting question, I think, which is the following, because with any company that works in the IT space, especially in healthcare like Taffy, issues of cybersecurity, privacy concerns are, of course, extremely, extremely serious. I was thinking, it's interesting because you really have two competing priorities in the case of healthcare. On the one hand, you need for healthcare experts and providers to be able to access individual records with precision and with stability. On the other hand, a lot of the machine learning algorithms will rely on large sets of data, where for privacy concerns, you potentially need to anonymize the data. Talk a little bit about some of these challenges and the extent to which cybersecurity and privacy concerns are different in your space than they are in general.
Healthcare data privacy is very heavily regulated. In the US, because we have a lot of private payers, it was adopted early on that patient privacy was a cornerstone and foundational for protecting patients from things like being uninsurable because of pre-existing conditions, as well as simply being foundational to kind of how our Constitution values privacy and our rights to not have the state looming over us and our data and using it for things that aren't with our permission. So we have a law in the U.S. Known as HIPAA.
It's that thing that makes you sign multiple pieces of paper when you go to any doctor.
Exactly. Every time you go to the doctor's office, they make you sign it. And they want you to sign other things that lets them do other things that you don't. Yeah. It's extra forms with the doctor that basically say that you consent to let the doctor know things about you and that it's okay. And that they will not share those things with other people unless you give them permission. So TAFI falls squarely in the sights of HIPAA. We are not above it. We are not beyond it. We have to play in that space and be very careful over how we collect data, how we transmit it, and how we store it. And the concept of anonymization or de-identification of patient information is quite contentious in healthcare specifically because healthcare has a lot of non-discrete data. What that means is if your physician writes a note and they use your name or possibly your address or any sort of number of identifiable variables in a written note, so something that they type up, like a history and physical, if that can be found in your electronic record, your record is not de-identified. So TAFI, just like a number of other companies, we go through great lengths to ensure that we are being as careful in scrutinizing connectivity and interoperation of any data and data formats so that we comply with HIPAA. And, you know, one of the good things that we've seen across the industry is that most everyone is very concerned about this. A HIPAA violation is no joke. I think it's like $1 million for your first violation. And you can be, you know, charged $1 million per patient record that gets leaked or that gets inadvertently routed somewhere. So HIPAA is, you know, something that every organization at every level, small, large, massive, takes into account. And so as we start partnering with different organizations, everyone kind of generally starts with, how do we make sure that we're doing right by the patient, right by privacy standards, right by the laws to protect those individuals? Whether that's making sure that we're, you know, using derived data for concepts of like machine learning, where we're not using anything that's possibly identifiable at all, where if we're doing anything with the non-discrete data, that we are scrubbing those text blobs and trying to scrape every known name has been identified in a name dictionary possible to be as adherent to the law as possible, and also to provide as much data as we can to some of those future initiatives. Because what a lot of providers will tell you is that they may have a great set of labs from a patient from who went to, let's say, Quest Diagnostics or to LabCorp or to a LabCorp lab, but the interpretation by the physician, that clinical context that's written in that nondiscrete note, is something that they wish they could analyze on a more regular basis or have presented them more often than not. And so being able to dive into that deeper level of data is something that would be really exciting for the machine learning space, especially once we can get unlock a lot of that information on a more consistent basis and not have to rely on people manually going through the chart and abstracting that information. It's a lot of human effort to get to machine learning.
So, I mean, I've heard and read that, in fact, it's virtually impossible to anonymize data, especially if you've got multiple databases or data sets that are combined together. There's always a way to figure something out because there's enough public data available that you can triangulate with something that's outside of the set that is supposedly anonymized. Do you buy that?
No, for sure. There's always a way. The goal is to just be as diligent as possible so that you're providing as much capacity to prevent that in a normal workflow between organizations that are agreeing to share information. In general, if information needs to go into a more public consortium or public forum or possibly truly public, like what CMS does, data gets derived and aggregated. And at the aggregated level, it's much harder to personally identify an individual.
Kevin, one more thing which would be interesting for our listeners to hear is your origin story. How did Teffy get started? How did you come up with the idea? How did you assemble the team?
Yeah, absolutely. So Teffy is an idea I like to say is probably about 13 years in the making. I was not even aware that healthcare IT was a field of practice when I graduated from college. I was pretty intent on going to med school and being a doctor and definitely not contributing to the data interoperability problem. Instead, I segued. I got a job offer with a company called Cerner. They're one of the largest, if not the largest, electronic medical record software vendors in the country. And it really opened my eyes to how far behind healthcare was the rest of the world in terms of like the type of software that was necessary to accomplish what had been done on paper for centuries. And I was fascinated by this problem. I walked into an emergency department early on in my career. I saw everyone charting on paper and I just looked at them like, why? And then I saw the resistance to change and I saw like just this entirely strange orchestration of paper flying all over the place, move into this electronic and organized and systematic approach to medicine. And from then on, I was hooked. And so across my career, a lot of personal experiences, a lot of work experiences continue to shape an opinion that at the root of all evil in healthcare is a piece of data that cannot get from point A to point B properly. That's probably at the most high level what continues to motivate me. And then I was able to meet a number of individuals along the way who believed me. And as we found customers, as we listened to customer stories, we were able to successfully convince them that getting data from point A to point B was at the root of a problem for them that had financial implication, that had clinical quality implication, and that had just general ease of use implication. So making someone's life easier because they don't have to log in twice into a system is meaningful. It improves their quality of work and hopefully improves the quality of care that they deliver.
Following on what you just said, when you go to a doctor's office now, you must see it with different eyes from the ones you used 13 years ago. I mean, do you identify all of the things that can be solved? You know, what drives you crazy when you go to a doctor's office now?
Got it. Yeah. So it used to be the way that the doctors were using electronic medical records or floating between their pen and paper in one hand and their computer screen in the other, and kind of watching them work through the EMR and not really know what to do. And I'd be like, oh yeah, point here, click here, do this. Now I don't really do that anymore. A lot of the doctors that I'm seeing now are really savvy. They're doing a great job documenting well and consistently inside the EMRs. And I evaluate them because I look at the record pretty often. So do a lot of people in Taffy because I make it available to them to experiment on me with. But now what kind of drives me crazy is essentially the interactivity I have with my doctors or during the clinical visit. A lot of physicians are so good at documenting the EMR that in real time, they're facing a computer screen and they're apologetic. They have good bedside manner, but the level of interactivity with the clinician now is different. A lot of it is making sure that they're getting all of their quality measures checked off and that they're asking questions that are going to ensure that Medicare or Medicaid or the insurance company or whoever it is that's monitoring their work is going to sign off on how well they charted or documented. And it's kind of losing the personal feel. And so things that get me excited about this problem that I'm seeing are, you know, as interoperability gets better, we should start seeing newer technologies, more voice-activated types of technologies, things like, you know, physicians charting for an Amazon Alexa or a Google Home type device, and improve the interactivity while still producing good quality data that can be used to substantiate a lot of that quality metrics and reporting stuff that gets pushed out to the doctors, and then also provide better, richer data for things like ML and AI in the future.
So Marco, as an advisor to Taffy, what would you like to see them do? Where do you think the company should go? Where do you think the company's future is?
I think, of course, in the near future is addressing the challenge that Kevin has been articulating over the podcast, which is to lay the foundations, the plumbing, the basic infrastructure to address the interoperability of data in healthcare. And I think Kevin articulated very well how this is a foundation. It's one of the major problems that are affecting the sector right now. But I think TAFI has the potential to go beyond it. And I feel that once that basic challenge of interoperability is addressed, one of the key difficulties, the key challenges in healthcare will be an overabundance of data, clinical data, behavioral data from our Fitbits, our sports watches, our Apple watches, what have you. And I think there is a lot that at that point TAFI should try to do to help health practitioners prioritize data and to make artificial intelligence applications in healthcare more intelligent. My bias is that there is going to be more and more need for injections of domain expertise to guide the artificial intelligence in a way that is most productive in improving health outcomes. And this is where I hope that TAFI will progress in the future.
And Marco's absolutely right. It's kind of right now, it's the standard that we hope that we can get to. Something that we talk about internally a lot at TAFI is this concept of intelligent data management. Behavioral health, Fitbit data, any sort of environmental information, it can be streaming in on a continuous basis and you're getting millions upon millions of data points. And to think that we are at a point where we can have this proliferation of really interesting information blending with the standard cornerstones of information and having the technology to leverage it is very exciting. Some of the gateways to get there are aggregating this information appropriately, preparing it and standardizing it in a way that AI and machine learning can sit on top of it easily and make it, you know, making it a lot more plug and play. And those are some of the things that TAFI is very fascinated with in the future. And we hope that some of the foundations that we're laying and that we can get through them quick enough so that we can get into these next more interesting and exciting opportunities in the intelligent data management space.
That's a good place to end today. So thanks so much, Kevin, for taking the time. And thanks for the great interview. And good luck to you. Good luck to TAFI.
Okay, thanks very much.
I appreciate it. Thank you guys very much.
Hey, M4Edge listeners, don't change that channel. Coming right up, Marco and I have a really fun discussion about TAFI, the health IT industry, privacy concerns, flu shots, and all sorts of good stuff. Stick around. I think you'll really like it.
Marco, I took my kids to get their flu shots the other day at one of these, you know, doc-in-a-box places. We went to the urgent clinic at CVS for what should have been a pretty routine healthcare visit. And I came face-to-face with some of the electronic medical record stuff that Kevin was alluding to. CVS makes you sign in, and I was kind of in a rush to sign in on their slightly klutzy system. And I was signing in both my two kids, and they're 4 years apart, but of course, 4 years and 1 month apart. And so I put them as just 1 month apart. In other words, like twins with the longest labor ever, just because I was sort of in a rush to do this. And the nurse was good enough to catch it. She brought them in and said, yeah, I figured there was a mistake here. You know, she asked each of them for their birth dates to see on which one I had made the mistake. That should have been obvious since the older one is a head taller than the younger one. But regardless, merging the older record they had of my younger son, because he'd gotten shots before, with the new incorrect record I had just created for him with the wrong birth date, that is, was, you know, that took really more time than the shot itself, for sure. And of course, even had I not made that mistake, there were a ton of fields to fill in, not all of which I wasn't looking over her shoulder, but she was clicking and clicking and clicking and clicking. And, you know, there were multiple screens to go through, and it wasn't really it was painful for my kids, but it wasn't a painful experience really, because it was, you know, minutes, not hours. But I thought of Kevin immediately, and it did remind me, you know, this stuff, no matter how good we try to be about getting all the records down and getting everyone's information, it's not simple. There's not a good way, I don't think, to make it really painless and really seamless.
No, and experiences like the one you were just describing really bring home one problem with every kind of statistical analysis or data work, which we are also familiar with from our experience. It's garbage in, garbage out. Even when we were looking at economic issues or energy issues, you know that the first concern has to be the quality of the data, especially when in the case of economics, sometimes the data come from surveys, sometimes they are extremely delayed. And here, when we were discussing with Kevin really the nuts and bolts of how the data are collected, what are you looking for? How are you recording? How are you classifying different data points? And then you move on to the problem of having them collected on different standards and systems and don't talk to each other. For me, that was really, it was really stunning in the sense that the contrast between these very basic difficulties and the very inspiring promise of what we can achieve with artificial intelligence in the quality of healthcare, the contrast was just stunning. So I was really left wondering, okay, how long is it going to take us to fix the plumbing of the healthcare data? And what's going to happen to the fancy advances until we get there?
Right. I think there's a good point there in that systems, obviously systems that are built to work with each other are going to work with each other more easily. Systems that are built independently, you know, you need lots of connectors and you need lots of, you know, pipe connectors to continue the plumbing metaphor. And you have to have the right pipe connector or else there's a leak. And there's a lot of, you can envision a newly built system, right? If you sort of scrapped everything you had and just started from scratch, saying, all right, every healthcare provider, you now have to start out with this basic architecture. You could envision some real leaps. And in areas where there isn't as much of a historical data record, maybe something close to that is possible. Obviously, there's some bare bones level of health records in, you know, pretty much in every country. Births, at the very least, are generally recorded. Not always, I suppose. But anyway, I think that, you know, maybe the potential to leapfrog to a much more seamless system is actually greater in countries that have, you know, less baggage, less built-in infrastructure.
Yeah, it's a very good point, Michael. It's something that I've been thinking about for a lot of the other digital innovations. So the idea that the countries which are lagging behind in economic development and therefore have less capital, less infrastructure in place, can more easily leapfrog to new generations of technology. We've seen it, for example, with mobile communication technology becoming widespread much faster in countries that didn't have the network of phone lines you have in Europe or in the US. But there was something else that I found very interesting, and I would be very curious to hear what you think, which is how this changes the interaction between patient and doctor. Because the first reaction I had looking at the data revolution in healthcare was to say, okay, finally, my doctor is going to move away from whatever old wives' tales he was clinging on to, and we look at the damn data and be able to give me a better diagnosis. But now I wonder if what's going to happen in the next phase is that doctors are going to get so fascinated by the data and so absorbed by the data that they will forget to look at us and might miss some very obvious clues that their experience as physicians should instead pick up immediately. What do you think?
I mean, I've had that experience. I happen to like my internist, my primary care doctor a lot. I think he's very good. He's a good diagnostician, and he's sort of, you know, the style of medicine that I like. But I was there the year that they instituted a new EMR. I don't remember how many years ago it was. It wasn't ancient history, but a few years ago. And his bedside manner, whatever, his office demeanor definitely changed, where he was looking at the computer at least as much, if not more, as he was looking at me. I had a, you know, checkup recently where in the middle he sort of got logged out and had to ask for help from the intern who was with him. And it was no fault of his own. It was just a little bit of a ridiculous system. But I think some of that is happening. I do think that, look, if you could have sort of a perfect system where you could tell the thing all of the little aches and pains you have and or the big aches and pains you have, and it combined that with all of the knowledge of your genetic profile and your current most immediate health history and said, this is the thing you are suffering from. Take two aspirins and, you know, call me in the morning. That would be great. I think we are a long way from that, you know, perfect, you know, human free kind of diagnostician. I don't know that it's impossible. I just think it takes a while to get there. Between now and then, I think doctors have to get better and better at switching back and forth between, the screen and the person in front of them. I think they do, like, these systems theoretically should allow doctors to be, in a way, rely on their intuition, refine their intuition. I don't want to say rely on their intuition more, because you want this to be as data and evidence-based as possible, but to refine their use of intuition when the data is confusing to them. And so it should, at least in the meantime, in this sort of transition period, enable a more complete kind of healthcare and more effective, efficacious kind of healthcare system, I hope.
It's a very good point. The other thing, I'm really hoping that the work that TAFI and other companies are doing in this field will help us reduce healthcare costs through greater transparency. Like, healthcare costs in the US, we know, are exceedingly high by international standards, even when you compare them with the quality of health outcomes. Now, there are several reasons for this. One being that most of the frontier healthcare developments happen here in the US. So the cost of R&D is much higher. So it's not entirely waste. But I think a lot of the extra cost comes from inefficiencies due to lack of transparency. It's very hard. If you need a medical procedure, it's exceedingly hard to shop around and figure out where should you go? Where is the highest performance? And so I am hoping that as the quality of the interoperability of the data improves, that will be true not just at the input stage, so at the stage where the doctors can see and compare more data about me, but also at the output stage, so at the stage where I can have access to better data on the performance of different healthcare providers, and that I can do a cost-benefit analysis and choose in a more rational and cost-effective way.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, the online sites that I've seen in the last few years, in the times when I've had to shop for a doctor, have relied mostly on reviews, a Yelp type system. I think Health Grades maybe is one of them, where, you know, the doctors get, at least this is my memory of how Health Grades works. I might be confusing it with another system, but basically the doctors get reviewed by some of the patients they've had. And like Yelp, there are often wildly conflicting sometimes reviews. And they're often, you know, both positive and negative, done by people who had particularly exaggerated experience. And so it's unclear to me always if I'm seeing a representative sample. My intuition is that it's not a representative sample. And so I never quite know what to make of those grades. I know an orthopedist friend of mine hates that system. One bad encounter, or one, you know, misunderstood encounter or whatever, you know, kills him. There's another, I think it was by United Healthcare, which is the insurance that I used to have. I think they rated doctors based on average cost or something like that, which gives you, at least it's a data-based rating. It gives you a little bit more sense for, am I going to pay more to get my ankle fixed or whatever it is from this doctor than from that doctor. The same orthopedist said, look, I'm a specialist, so people come to me for the more complicated things. I charge more for my procedures. So of course my cost is going to be higher than a more general orthopedist. And, you know, I hadn't thought of that, but he's absolutely right. So I think where we need to go, you know, if people are willing to actually analyze, if citizens are actually willing to analyze the data, then I think you can envision a system where you get the full range of not just cost per specific procedure, but some rating of effectiveness. You know, did the guy diagnose the thing correctly? Did the doctor prescribe the right treatment? Did the patient get healthy in a reasonable amount of time. Easier to do in a hospital setting than in a, you know, doctor's office setting or outpatient setting. Hospital setting, they track, you know, everything. Whereas in an outpatient, you have to rely on whatever the patient reports, right? But I could see a scenario where costs begin to get leveled by a more true marketplace competition, you know, where you get rid of the information asymmetries that currently exist.
Exactly. I think that's exactly right. And what did you make of the discussion we had with Kevin about the interaction between smaller startups and tech giants like Google and others? I was a bit surprised that Kevin seemed to take such a positive attitude. I was expecting either a more concerned reaction or a dismissive reaction along the lines of these guys can never get it done. They know nothing about healthcare. And instead, his attitude seemed to be much more constructive, saying, you know, we need both areas. We need smaller companies which have the domain expertise and can get things started. But the involvement of the tech giants focuses the attention on the sector and can help scale. What did you make of that?
Yeah, you know, I also, it surprised me a little bit also. And I guess I had a few thoughts. One of them is that, look, you know, I don't know if this was Kevin's, you know, motive here or not, but startups don't necessarily want to poke the giant, right? I mean, there's, you don't want to, if you're a little guy, you don't really want to get into a fight with one of the tech majors necessarily, especially if, you know, potentially, I don't know if this is Taffy's business plan at all, but, you know, startups, sometimes their exit is getting bought out. So, you know, maybe that's part of it. But, I, you know, giving him more credit, I think there's a real argument to be made that the tech giants got to be tech giants often because they're good at what they do. And being good at what they do means having not just the right sense for how to market a product, but the right team and expertise to build the product. And so, although that we're in a moment now where there's a lot of, you know, tech giant hating, some of it because of the political moment we're in, some of it just because of the real or perceived oligopoly that we're in. You know, I think tech giants do some good in the world, right? I'm not personally a fan of Facebook. It has nothing to do with my admiration for them as a company. But, you know, I think that Google and Amazon, they do some pretty amazing things after all. And so I wouldn't discount the ability of major corporations that pay, you know, superstar programmers a lot of money to actually do something great.
It also touches on one dilemma or trade-off that has been around for a long time, but it's become especially topical now with these new waves of innovation, especially software innovation that cut across sectors. The question of whether domain expertise helps you or holds you back, that it helps you to focus the power of the artificial intelligence and the software in the right areas, or whether it holds you back because you're always looking at the problems in the same old way and you can't take the fresh look that somebody coming from the outside can. And I guess even when you and I were at G, we've seen both examples right of this, and we've talked about both sides, we've talked about both corners of our mouth, so to speak, where sometimes we say, oh look, it's great, we had to design this new jet engine bracket, and look at this young engineer from Indonesia, no background in aviation, comes up with a fantastic design, and then we would turn around and say, oh, but by the way, on the industrial internet side, we will do it better because we have the domain expertise that
that's right.
the Googles and the Microsofts don't.
Yeah, it's a great point. My own bias on this, and maybe it's because I'm more inclined to think that eventually AI is going to be able to do, you know, sort of everything. My bias on this is that domain expertise will become less and less important. Obviously, you need to know something in order to program the algorithm to, you know, do that thing to begin with, or to look for that thing to begin with. But increasingly, you know, we've seen this in a bunch of different domains, two separate things. One, that the programmers or the computer scientists themselves can't really explain what the algorithm is doing to get to the, you know, correct result or the desired result. They know that it's getting to those end results, but they're not exactly sure why. This has become, I suspect in medicine, it's going to become a much, much bigger deal. In law, it will as well. There's now a movement to, you know, demystify the quote black box of AI and to build in sort of algorithmic checkpoints or, you know, panels, you know, metaphorical panels. And so you can look under the hood of your algorithm. I don't know if that's going to be a successful movement or not. Not being a programmer, I don't know how much worse it makes the algorithm when you have to build in those latches. But that's sort of one area in which I think we've seen already that domain expertise is maybe sidelined or something. Again, the computer's able to do something that we don't understand. The second part is we've seen AIs able to do things better than humans. Medicine is the example people come back to more often than not, but for certain types of cancers or for certain types of diseases that one would find on a radiological scan, some of the algorithms are already better than all but the very best radiologists at identifying the illness, at identifying the signs or the patterns of the illness. And it's not because the guys who wrote that program were radiologists. They were informed by work that radiologists and radiological technicians did. Those algorithms viewed millions of scans. But the guys who wrote the code were not, quote, domain experts. And I think that will happen more and more.
I agree. And the black box aspect of AI is fascinating. As you were mentioning, it creates some feeling of unease. And definitely in Europe, this strong reluctance to allow a black box AI to take very powerful decisions in healthcare or other fields. I'm wondering, though, if the solution to this will not turn out to be actually easier than we think. Because if I think of how a human doctor takes decisions on a course of therapy, the doctor will be able to give you some reason, some explanation as to why he or she has reached the decision, but it will be a partial explanation. They will say, well, we've looked at this data, we've looked at these symptoms, but there is an area of uncertainty where the doctor's intuition kicks in. And so I'm wondering if we're going to go the same route for the AI, where we will be able to teach the AI to give us some parameters and say, okay, these are some of the things I've taken into account. They've guided me in this direction. And then there will be the equivalent of human intuition, which will remain the black box side of AI.
Right. Well, right. It's as if saying that AI's flaw is that it's a black box, you know, it begs the question, well, how much do you really understand about what your doctor or whoever, whatever expert you're looking at is really making, you know, what do you know about how they're making their decision? It's not as if you, exactly, you know, try to, you know, question the experts in front of you. Well, do I really have, you know, the flu or, you know, why don't you think I have Legionnaire's disease or something? What led you to that conclusion?
Yep.
I think getting to the point that you suggested where we can trust the computer to not be perfect, I think that's really the catch. And that's across many branches of, or many applications of AI. I was at a conference last week. It was NVIDIA's GPU technology conference, the GTC in Washington, DC. And I sat in most of the conference. I spent in the session they did on autonomous vehicles. And in some regards, the AVs are already better than humans. I mean, there are still a ways to go for them to be deemed safe. But in some cases, it's inarguable. You know, they have a 360-degree view of everything around them. You know, humans physically cannot do that. There are other examples, but to me, that's the most obvious one. And I asked one of the representatives there, you know, what's left to do? I mean, we've seen cars drive themselves for many, many, many miles without, you know, a driver with hands on the wheel, you know, perfectly changing lanes and stopping at stop signs and, you know, avoiding kids that run out into the street chasing balls. You know, we've seen video of all of these things. What do we have left to do? And the answer I got, and maybe, I don't know if this is, it's clearly not representative of the entire industry, but the answer I got was, yeah, we just have to do more. You know, it's not so much a fundamental science question. The fundamental science question is simply, we have to prove it more. And my takeaway from that was, we're never going to get to the point where we will be fully satisfied that the AV, or the autonomous vehicle, or the AI in general, is so perfect that we don't have questions about it, right? We have to just get to the point where enough people are sufficiently comfortable to say, okay, let's pass this hurdle, right? There's this weird sort of amorphous and maybe moving goal line that we seem to be setting for ourselves now. But it's not simply equal to humans. It's so much better than humans that we're okay with a little scintilla of doubt.
There's a double standard. There is definitely a double standard, because my thought for a long time has been that, look, when you're comparing autonomous vehicles to the average human driver, that's actually setting a pretty low bar. The average human driver, certainly in the Bay Area where I live, the average human driver sucks.
It scares me.
I want more AVs on the road. I can't wait. But somehow we are fully tolerant of the mistake of the human driver who's texting and driving at the same time. But a small mistake by an autonomous vehicle, that's unacceptable. That freaks us out.
Exactly.
And at some point, we have to get beyond this double standard and look at the numbers, look at the averages, and just realize what the risk truly is.
Yeah. Let us know, listeners, what you think of these kinds of discussions that Marco and I have. If you like them, if you think we should take on a different tack, and send us some comments.
And keep in mind, they really stress me out. So if you don't like them, tell us, please tell us.
Great. All right. Good for now.
Excellent.